This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. With the two Dallas nurses becoming infected with Ebola after caring for Thomas Eric Duncan, the first man to die from the disease in the U.S., the fear of Ebola has taken this country by storm. Hospitals and health facilities around the country have begun rigorous assessment of their own readiness and infectious control protocols. Well, here with more on this is Christopher Dunham. He's the Emergency Management Director for Upstate Medical University and University Hospital. Welcome, Chris. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So first, help us understand or better understand what we really now know about the transmission of Ebola. You know, when is it infectious and who may be at risk?
Well, what we know now is a sort of an extension of what we've always known. It's not airborne, and there's been a lot of panic surrounding this. It's bloodborne or contact precautions, in other words, body fluids. Evidenced in Dallas, the people living with the original patient wound up being free from Ebola. So there is a transmission rate that they currently look at, but it's not always 100%.
So the point is, you are only infectable, that's the other question. When is it infectious? In other words, a person can have it in their body.
Yeah, for quite a while. Yeah, typically the incubation period goes from anywhere from 8 to 21 days. And if you are what the term is asymptomatic or not having any symptoms such as fever, flu-like symptoms, things like that, typically you're not contagious. The moment you start getting a fever or getting those other symptoms, which are on the CDC website and our website as well, you can go ahead and consider yourself, that would be when they consider people contagious.
Right, then they're infectious
right.
to others, but only
if,
but if somehow their bodily fluids mm-hmm. come into contact with someone else's skin
yep.
or some way of getting into the other person's
correct.
Body.
Correct.
Does the Ebola protocol that is that you undertake right now, does it differ from other infectious disease protocols? And if so, in what way?
I think it differs in two major respects. Number one is the level of mortality with it necessitates a large degree of training and a large use of personal protective equipment for our own staff safety. Certainly, personal protective equipment is sort of the day in and day out usage for all of our clinical staff. But with Ebola, especially given what's happened recently, we've really amped it up and exceeded CDC guidelines for Upstate almost since the beginning of this sort of event in the United States.
So the point is, because it's so virulent, because it's such a killer.
Yes.
It's that much more serious in a way.
Correct. And other things are certainly not less serious, but the chances you take are greater to some extent, and certainly there isn't a magic time frame where someone can be around somebody who has Ebola where you may not get it. You know, there is no magic foot rule in terms of, you know, 5 feet, 10 feet, whatever.
Oh, I see. That's interesting too. So, you know, I know that they've been the country has been kind of rocked by these two nurses
mm-hmm.
being infected. And so the government has stepped up and appointed this new Ebola czar
mm-hmm.
recently. How do you think what will the public see that will be different as a result of this?
My sincere hope is better communications from the federal government level, especially in the CDC, on changes through what they're trying to do or attack or support local communities or local healthcare institutions. Also, I believe there would be at least a clear chain of command in terms of less duplication of resources, better use of physicians and healthcare teams. Also, and I know the CDC has recently come out with, they're starting to, let's say a hospital in the Midwest would have somebody who would be a highly suspected case. They would actually send a team of physicians and nurses and infectious disease experts to that location to help them out. And during the initial stages of the Dallas event, I don't think they had that for quite some time.
So they have kind of an emergency team.
Yeah, kind of a go team.
Yeah.
Yeah, which would be great. I mean, that's a big help.
The other thing is that I think you may not even have the answer to this because I haven't been able to find it, but it's been alluded to throughout the last several weeks in terms of how the country will handle subsequent cases of Ebola. I mean, is there a sense that they're going to, you know, I know we have these four centers
right.
that are very highly skilled. I mean, they've done it many, many, many times.
For years.
And then we have the rest of our 5,000 hospitals and health centers throughout the country that haven't, obviously, however well prepared they may think they are. So I guess the question is, have they come up with an idea as to what's going to happen to cases that may happen somewhere away from these four centers?
No, there's nothing official that's been communicated as of yet. As it stands right now, these four centers have these infectious disease units, and they train rigorously, and this is pretty much all they train to do. We're certainly preparing for that and upping our training, but there's been no official word that a patient in Syracuse would automatically go to one of these four centers, although I'm sure at that point nothing is off the table.
Yeah, they're still working out these details, I know, because it's been alluded to, and I've heard some of the national figures talking about it, that we would maybe bring, and they have brought these two nurses to centers, that kind of
thing. It was very telling for me for those two nurses to go to those centers.
Rather than being left in Dallas.
Exactly, or at another facility.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Christopher Dunham. He's Emergency Management Director for Upstate Medical University and University Hospital. We're talking about Ebola and what is being done to prevent its spread. Well, locally in New York State, recently, Governor Cuomo designated Upstate University Hospital, I guess, as one of eight hospitals in the state to handle patients diagnosed with the Ebola virus. Well, what does that mean when you get a hospital designation of that kind?
For us, it's an opportunity to expand our capabilities. We're actively training and dedicating separate space to take care of these patients, but also it helps our regional partners to have them, if they have a suspected case or a highly suspected case or a clinically confirmed case, to actually transport them to us for further care and treatment. It's a way of hospitals to link together and work together a little more efficiently.
Now, the truth is, for years, you have been doing drills. I mean, there was SARS at one point. There was the threat of bioterrorism at one point.
H1N1.
H1N1 came by, and avian flu. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about these kinds of things, plus natural disasters. So I know you've had disaster or emergency management things in place.
Oh, yeah, for quite a while.
So how is that changing, or how is it different in this particular climate?
For us, we've actually looked yearly at sort of identifying our top five risks. And since I can remember, number two or three on the list, no matter when it was always pandemic/epidemics. And it's always something that we've identified as a very big drain on resources, on personnel, on equipment, on everything. And that's how we kind of look at emergency management. It can be a very small event, but it could have a very big impact on the facility. So trying to mitigate that impact is what we try to do. Now, for Ebola, the resources in terms of separation, staff dedication, and sort of keeping everything as safe as possible for our staff is paramount. It also creates some unique logistical issues. We've exceeded CDC guidelines for the personal protective equipment for quite some time now. And every time, I think it was recently, they updated it.
Yeah, they just recently came out and said now no skin can show.
Right. And we've had that in process for quite a while, but we've added parts and pieces to that equipment to further enhance that. In other words, we want to make that equipment as simple as possible for our folks to get in and out of and as safe as possible. The more complex it is, the worse, the more likely somebody would make a mistake taking it off.
Absolutely.
So as we do that, we try to buy more things or procure more things, and we're finding that there's national shortages on PPE right now. Certainly there's a lot that's been sent over to West Africa. And that creates some logistical issues that we've been able to overcome, but it's been kind of a challenge for us. Also, we need to take a good look at these patients because the mortality rate is so high in most instances. You know, clinically, this offers some dynamic things that are currently being worked on. And also, what do you do with the waste when somebody comes into one of these hospitals?
That was a good question asked.
Even the sheets they sleep on, you know, that cannot just simply be thrown out. All those things have been addressed and are currently being worked out. And we're actually aggressively, what I like to call drilling it or testing it, see if it works, see where, you know, we do a lot of dry runs and okay, what do we do ifs and things like that.
Yeah, I'm just going to ask you that. So can you help us understand, so what is supposed to happen if somebody walked into the emergency department today and they felt sick and they had traveled to West Africa recently? What's supposed to happen?
all patients that arrive in our facility will be asked some very important questions when they come in. The first and foremost is you know, have you traveled to West Africa, and have you had any contact with anybody who's been clinically diagnosed with Ebola? Those things are pretty much standard. We make sure the priority here is identification and safe handling of that patient and protection of our staff. So let's say that patient does get identified. They get moved to an isolation room, separated from everybody else as quickly as possible. And then the wheels start going where we integrate with the local county emergency management, Onondaga Department of Health, and then we also go to the State Department of Health and the CDC, and we start relying on them as well for other resources. But we have a process within the hospital that once that person is identified by those three simple questions, that a lot of things get brought to bear to ensure the safety of everybody else in the room, and to also make sure we provide good quality patient care for that patient.
So it sounds to me that you have a tremendous responsibility now in terms of all the different levels of training. I mean, it's even just the registration people alone, which would be basically the front line, you need to recognize the potential for somebody to walk in with a problem.
Yeah, we've done a tremendous amount of training so far. In just the registration piece alone, and our what I would call our frontline staff, they've all gone through initial training, awareness level training. They've actually drilled this yesterday. And we're not just talking about the hospital. All of our outpatient clinics, all of our associated people that we work with, all the doctor's offices, we've tried to reach out and provide as much information as we can at the moment, and to do that as accurately as possible.
Would you say the protocol is the same whether the patient is adult or pediatric?
The pediatrics is kind of the big question right now. There isn't a tremendous amount of information out there. The protocol is relatively the same. In other words, the isolation and things like that. The wild card for us is if you have a pediatric patient, the family is a huge consideration, because certainly if you have a 3-year-old pediatric patient, you can't necessarily separate them from mom and dad relatively easily. So there's some considerations and some things we're looking into. But pediatrics is, surprisingly, there's not a lot of data coming out of West Africa regarding that at the moment. So we're currently pursuing
it.
Yeah, we're pursuing that.
This is a work in progress, obviously, for everyone. Continuously.
For the past 10 days, I mean, we have a guidance document, sort of a playbook we've developed. And I think last week it got updated almost twice daily.
Yeah.
So it's been constant revision.
Well, you and the CDC and the NIH and what's happening with WHO, I mean, everywhere.
Yeah, there's a tremendous amount of people clinically and non-clinically that have been working on this at Upstate.
So with all of the things, are you also involved in educating first responders?
Not yet, but we've definitely shared our communications with them. And right now it's about information sharing mode. And certainly we like to work with our local EMS partners and give them anything they need.
And the staff are being trained to use these PPEs correctly. And in the case, I think, in Texas, there was some concern about how they used them.
Right.
So that they're being trained to use them properly and to really maintain that high level of care.
We've identified the staff that would deal with that patient, so we don't have to train everybody. We're focusing on the people who would actually care for the patient.
So in summary, would you say that you're ready?
Absolutely. We're as ready as we can be right now, and we're going to get better as the weeks go on.
Well, I appreciate your coming in. I think that gives us all a lot of peace of mind. I appreciate your being here. My guest has been Christopher Dunham, the Emergency Management Director for Upstate Medical University and University Hospital. Once again, thanks for joining us, Chris.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.